From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. I did not collude, says President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner. This morning, he released 11 pages of prepared remarks for the lawmakers he's meeting with today and tomorrow to answer questions about his contacts with Russia. He also said he has nothing to hide. Mark Murray is senior political editor for NBC News. Hi, Mark.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And some of the questions going into this week were, what happened in meetings that Kushner had with the Russian ambassador? Did he ask for a secret back channel to President Putin? Why did he also meet with a Russian banker? How much did Kushner know about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russian lawyer that he, Kushner, also attended? And what about the suspicions, as McClatchy News reported, that Kushner funneled digital data from the Trump campaign to Russians interfering in the election? So let's start with the meeting with the Russian ambassador. This is in November after the election. General Michael Flynn also there. What did we learn from the statement today, the release statement?
Yeah, so the statement that he said was that he had a very limited interaction during the campaign with Russia Ambassador Kislyak in April of 2016. It came in Washington, D.C. during his foreign policy speech that then-candidate Trump was giving. And Kushner essentially said this was very limited in interaction, that their pleasantries were exchanged, they had a nice little conversation. And then later, as he ended up relaying in his letter, he couldn't even remember Kislyak's last name. And so trying to make the point that this was nothing more than just kind of a nice cursory type of event.
But he did also ask for a direct line to President Putin, and he asked about, you know, even phone lines, maybe through the Russian embassy. Now, he's saying in a statement, the fact that I'm even asking for a connection to Putin shows that our campaign didn't have one. But tell us more about why he wanted that.
Yeah. And so this actually happened during the transition. And to me, this is the most striking part of the entire statement that Kushner released, and maybe the most eyebrow raising part for members of Congress if it ended up occurring during the closed doors. And essentially, he ended up meeting with Kislyak during the transition after Trump won, but when Barack Obama was still president. And they discussed Kislyak saying that he had information from Russia's generals that he wanted to share with Trump and his team about the war in Syria, and that they wanted to be able to have that kind of discussion. And what Kushner ended up saying was that, look, I don't want, there was no back channel type of communication. But Kushner did confirm that he asked if he could actually use Russia's embassy to be able to have that kind of conversation. And the reason why this is maybe so significant is that this was occurring when Barack Obama was still president. And yet you ended up having the transition of the Trump team wanting to have, if it wasn't a back channel communication, it was still some kind of communication within Russia's embassy to talk with a country that's considered an adversary of the United States on several issues.
And certainly isn't secure. But I want to move on to some of the other things that we learned from this chain, because there are more questions have been raised, maybe some settled. That meeting with Donald Trump Jr. and the Russian lawyer, there was that email chain that began with a family friend saying that the lawyer had dirt from the Russian government on Hillary Clinton. Kushner seems to be saying he never read into the chain. He just took the meeting. He just read the top email inviting him. And then he came late. And once he got in, he texted to a friend, "Can you please call me on my cell? I need excuse to get out of meeting."
That's right. And he ended up saying the part that he ended up listening to was on the subject of quote unquote Russian adoptions, which, you know, for people who've actually followed this issue is more relating to sanctions and the Russian adoption freeze ended up occurring after the Russian government was upset about the sanctions the United States government had ended up passing. And what Kushner said was that was the only thing that was part of the discussion was this Russian adoptions. Nothing he ended up saying had to do with Hillary Clinton or potential dirt on her, but it does raise the question of did that information come out before or after he ended up leaving the meeting? Yeah. And Kushner ended up saying, hey, I just read into this chain. I had nothing idea about whether it was related to Hillary Clinton or not. But that's what he says his explanation is on that meeting with that Russian attorney.
He didn't seem to address the questions about when he ran the Trump campaign digital data team and whether or not that team flagged Russia on what they knew about targeting voters. But overall, Mark Murray, again, we've got 2 days of testimony behind closed doors. What did this statement do about the court of public opinion?
We have a long ways to go in this story, but to me, when you actually look at the court of public opinion, it is still very significant, in some ways very odd, that you ended up having a presidential campaign team having these types of conversations and meetings with the Russian government, or even with a Russian banker who this was also later that Kushner ended up confirming that he was able to meet with a banker by the name of Sergei Gavrov. So you add all these things up, a presidential campaign team, and even in the transition, it's all about getting votes from Americans. It is about staffing up your own government. And having all of these types of meetings during the campaign and then during the transition, I think only raise more questions than answers.
Well, and he, of course, posits them as, just a couple of thousands of meetings that he took. So we'll see. Mark Murray, senior political editor for NBC News. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, in a surprise move today, Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, vetoed two bills that would have given his right-wing government more control over the country's courts. Critics warned the judicial reforms would amount to a turn toward authoritarianism. The BBC's Kevin Connolly joins us from Brussels. And Kevin, there were multiple laws at issue here. What exactly would they have done?
It was a complex suite of separate pieces of legislation, but the overall effect would have been pretty simple and pretty clear. And that would have been to place the appointment of most judges, and particularly judges of the Supreme Court, very directly under the immediate control of the day-to-day government. And of course, lots of liberals within Polish society, lots of people in the European Commission in Brussels, lots of people in the State Department in Washington felt that that broke a fundamental rule of democracy, that a government should not directly appoint judges. President Andrzej Duda, who had in his hands the final step of the legislative process, which is to sign those bills as president, decided that even though they'd been through both chambers of the Polish parliament, he would not sign them in their current form. That has had the effect of diffusing what was beginning to feel like a crisis in Poland, where liberal protesters were out on the streets over all of this, and also diffused a looming confrontation with the European Commission in Brussels, which was uncomfortable with this and which was planning very strong political sanctions against the Polish government.
Now, President Duda vetoed two laws, but he did approve a third, giving the justice minister the right to appoint people to lead Poland's lower courts. How significant is that?
I think it's significant in terms of the internal political dynamics in Poland. Andrzej Duda is a figure of the ruling Law and Justice Party, the party that has a majority in the Polish parliament, the party that ran for office promising judicial reform. So he didn't want to look as though he was stepping away from all of these ideas, but he has stepped away from the more controversial ones. He said they need more thought, they need to be redrafted. So he is not saying to his supporters that they were wrong to want reform of the judiciary, but he is also saying that these laws don't work in their current form, are problematic. I think he's made a pretty careful political calculation there to back down in this international confrontation without looking as though he's alienating his own supporters at home.
Now, was it the mass protests on the streets in Poland, or was it this outside pressure that you're talking about from the United States and from Europe that got the Polish president to do this?
Well, that's a really good question, and like all really good questions, it's pretty much unanswerable. Only Andrzej Duda, of course, really knows the answer to that, and I would throw in a third factor too. It is possible he is a lawyer. He is seen as something of a man of principle in Polish political circles. It is possible that he simply felt uncomfortable with the idea that the government would be taking into its hands very direct control over the appointment of judges and over the operation of the courts. So we will see what sort of role he plays when new proposals on judicial reform are put forward, and to what extent he's able to insist that any new reforms are acceptable to Poland's international partners.
So what happens now? And are people who have been saying Poland is moving toward authoritarianism, will they not be saying that anymore?
Poland is a very deeply divided society. And I think, you know, I was listening to a Polish judge talking earlier on, and he was in no doubt that this is a reprieve for Poland's liberal parties, if you like, for Poland's liberal instincts. And he had no doubt that Andrzej Duda had decided to align Poland with its better angels, that he saw Poland as a country which is, in effect, torn between the pressures of becoming more and more like the democracies of Western Europe, or retreating back towards an older tradition of Eastern authoritarianism. He thought at the 11th hour, Andrzej Duda had made a wise choice, but this issue is not going away. Law and Justice, the ruling party, would say that they have a clear and explicit mandate to reform the judiciary. Everything now depends on whether they moderate their ambitions, that they try to reform the judiciary but not reform it so profoundly, or whether they can formulate their ideas in a way that the United States, the European Union, can feel comfortable with. That's a big challenge. You can expect a lot of parliamentary rewriting over the summer. I would say this is very likely to fade from the headlines for a couple of months, but this issue is not finished, it's not done, and it will be back in the headlines, I would say, in the autumn.
That's the BBC's Kevin Connolly joining us from Brussels. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The winner of RuPaul's Drag Race, America's next drag superstar, is Sasha Velour.
Sasha Velour, the stage name of Sasha Steinberg, won season 9 of RuPaul's Drag Race, the VH1 reality TV show. You might remember Velour's gleaming bald head, her dramatic eyebrows that she says were inspired by Frida Kahlo. But what's probably most unique about Sasha is her very intellectual approach to drag. The Atlantic calls her a cerebral Brooklyn artist. Sasha Velour joins us now from Durham, North Carolina, where she's on what's called the War on the Catwalk Tour with other contestants from RuPaul's Drag Race. Sasha Velour, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And one of the things that people, even people who don't watch RuPaul's Drag Race, if they've seen you on it, they see that there is something very different about you than most drag queens out there. What is that? What is it that you bring that sets you apart?
Well, I think some people might describe it as being terribly serious. The truth is I do take drag really seriously, and I think that there's kind of a place for that, to see it as this political and historical art form and to want to continue pushing it in new directions and also honor the old directions as well. So I'm sort of like a drag intellectual slash drag queen.
Well, you say you're a drag intellectual. You were a Fulbright scholar. You have a master's degree. Tell us a little bit about your educational background.
Yeah, so I went to Vassar College for undergraduate and studied literature and queer theory and all of the above. And then I kind of I took a Fulbright scholarship in Russia. And that's really where my direction shifted a little bit, because I became really interested in what kind of work actually helps to change things for queer people. And I became really fascinated with drag because it's such an accessible and joyful art form. And I wanted to create beautiful images in drag that would not just inspire queer people who need to see some beauty and need to experience some joy, but also would engage people politically, get political discussions started in gay bars, in the queer community, and really inspire people to action as well as to wearing a few more sequins and a little bit more glitter.
Political discussions like what?
We need to talk about representation for queer people in the media and also in law. And there's a long history of drag queens leading those discussions in marches on the street and even in bars, going back to the time of Stonewall and before. Gay bars have always been spaces of getting angry about politics and about legal situations, and we need that now more than ever.
Do you think that drag queens have a role to play right now in the debate over transgender rights?
Absolutely, because drag is so much more than gay men dressing up as women. It's about creating space and creating validity for people who want to express gender differently and by their own rules. And drag queens, drag kings need to be at the forefront of pushing for rights and protections and safe spaces for the entire spectrum of gender nonconforming and trans people.
Now, another thing that sets you apart is that you tend not to wear a wig. You have a shaved head, which has its own story. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Right when I was starting to experiment with drag, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and during her chemo treatment, she lost all of her hair. And for her, the idea of being a femme with no hair was really difficult. But I really actually appreciated that she didn't wear wigs at the time, that she didn't wear hats or scarves. She just let her beautiful bald head air out, and she found ways to make it beautiful with earrings and with fashion. And I love that so much, I wanted to pay tribute to that with my own drag.
Are there other bald queens?
Oh, there's such a long history of bald queens. I think about New York legends like Kevin Aviance, who've tied in baldness with a kind of androgynous drag or a non-binary drag. And I love that too, because to me, pushing against a very strict idea of femininity is something that I love about drag and that I think we need to see even more of.
One of the most famous moments from this season of the show is you taking off a wig and rose petals coming out from underneath it. How did you get that idea? Tell us a little bit about that.
I'm sort of fascinated. When I was a little kid, I wanted to be a magician. And I sort of see that drag is a bit of a magic trick at times, too. And that's partly what keeps people so captivated. So I thought a lip sync performance was a great time to do a little magic trick. And so I stuffed my wig and my gloves full of rose petals and revealed them at different moments during Whitney Houston's So Emotional. Because what's more emotional, what's more extra than just like a bath of rose petals?
There was one moment on the show last season I want to ask you about. One of the drag queens, Eureka O'Hara, made a joke about eating disorders in one episode. She later apologized, and you had this to say.
It's a sensitive issue for me because I was severely anorexic for my entire early 20s. I was so, like, unhealthy looking. People would, like, call me E.T. and stuff because the way that I looked on the street. It was like, I have a lot of hurt from it still.
After that moment, two of the other drag queens opened up about their own eating disorders. Is this a big problem in the drag community?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's even more than that. Even this season, who have experienced trying to deal with body image and eating disorders. So I'm glad that we had that discussion. I'm definitely not as much of a, like, destroyer of humor as maybe I came across in that moment. But I think it's important to talk about the things, to talk about things as well as joking about them.
How did your parents react to you going down this path?
At first, they were a little confused. They didn't really know that much about drag. Maybe they had some misunderstandings about what it was or what that lifestyle was like. But they've really, my dad especially, has really come around since he's had a chance to see me on the show.
I read that he drove up to a gay bar in Chicago to watch you on the show.
Yeah, he hosted some viewing parties in our hometown of Urbana, Illinois, for all of his professor friends. They would watch together. And then he was actually in San Francisco when the final episode aired. And it was caught on video of him watching me win the crown, which was amazing. It was so moving.
Well, you mentioned our hometown of Urbana, Illinois. You and I actually went to the same high school, although not at the same time. Not at the
exactly.
same time.
Exactly. Legends of you were still being discussed when I was there.
Well, did that have anything to do with how you got interested in this, or?
Totally. Yeah, we went to this experimental high school that really pushed people to think independently and to take everything a little too seriously. And I think I've always carried that attitude and that culture with me wherever I go.
Do you think it's difficult for kids who want to get into drag to do so still?
No. It's the simplest thing. You just go and you find whatever you can find. If it's like a simple pair of heels, or if you have to strap some like cans of food to the back of your shoes so that you have that little lift. If you want to go and get some mascara, if you have to use a little Sharpie on your eye, like, you can make drag out of absolutely anything. And if that is what inspires you, I say everyone should go out and do it.
So what are you going to do next? I know that you operate a magazine about drag.
Yeah, I'm the artistic director of an art magazine about drag. And it's photos and interviews and illustrations, all that try to capture this wonderful history and wonderful culture of drag. And I also have been producing a monthly show in New York where we offer the magazine as well as fabulous drag performances from queens all over the country.
How did you end up on RuPaul's Drag Race?
I had auditioned for a couple years. I auditioned for one season before, for season 8, and I didn't make the cut. I didn't get any phone calls. They totally weren't interested. And then I'm someone who, I try to change as fast as I can, just as many new things as I can explore. So then by the next year, my drag had completely shifted in new directions. And then I got the call. I actually got the call while I was visiting my dad in Russia, in the airport, and I hurried back to New York with only 14 days to prepare to go film. It was a really wild experience, and that was about a year ago.
Now, I've seen a sped up video of you getting ready, preparing, turning into Sasha Velour. It's an unbelievable amount of stuff that you have to do in order to get there. How often are you switching back and forth between yourself and Sasha Velour?
These days, I become Sasha Velour every night, pretty much.
You have to do that every single night? You don't ever just leave it on?
No, I have to reshave my entire head and face and chest and arms. And then I cover all of it with makeup and contour everything, even up to the back of my head. And then slather it with beautiful eye makeup and lipstick and lashes until it's done.
You never just leave it on for a night?
Nope. Mm-mm. I would hate to think what the pillow would look like if I even tried.
That's Sasha Velour, the season 9 winner of RuPaul's Drag Race. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And you can watch that video of Sasha Steinberg becoming Sasha Velour at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first 3 meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
President Trump says he wants to let the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare fail. He's repeated the threat over and over in news conferences and on Twitter. And yesterday on Face the Nation, Anthony Scaramucci, the White House communications director, echoed the president's position.
He would like to repeal and replace Obamacare. If you're going to stop him from doing that, the next best thing would be to repeal Obamacare. If you're not going to repeal and replace Obamacare, then the third best thing is let it implode.
The idea that it's already imploding is something the administration has been saying, but NPR's Allison Kojak reports that Obamacare isn't collapsing on its own. The president and his team are actively undermining the Affordable Care Act markets.
If you look at Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price's Twitter feed, you might get the impression he's cheering on the collapse of the Affordable Care Act. There are videos in his feed like this one.
And some of the issues that we have had with Obamacare is constantly changing plans.
Which are made by his department, featuring people complaining about the health law. And there are graphics emphasizing problems in the insurance markets while downplaying the places where they're working well. Beyond Twitter, Price has held multiple so-called listening sessions with people from across the country. In a recent one at the White House, he told them that the law is the source of all problems in the health insurance markets.
And this challenge is an inherent challenge that exists because of the flaws within Obamacare, within the ACA.
Andy Slavitt is the former head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which also runs the Obamacare exchanges.
This appears to be the use of taxpayer resources to undermine a law that's been passed by Congress.
Slavitt says the president and his team have created instability in the markets by refusing to say whether they'll continue to make payments that allow insurance companies to offer discounts on deductibles and copayments.
The role of the administration is not to decide which laws they like and which laws they don't like. and only enforce the laws that they like.
For example, the administration says it won't enforce the part of the law that requires people to buy insurance. Insurers say these actions have led them to boost premiums, which in turn has more people refusing to buy coverage. The administration could choose to make the Affordable Care Act markets work better, says Tom Policelli. He's CEO of Minuteman Health, which sells Obamacare plans in New Hampshire and Massachusetts.
There are some practical steps that could be taken right now in Washington that could lower premiums for 2018 today. And when I say lower premiums, I mean 20 to 35% lower.
Policelli knows how the administration's publicity machine works. Last month, when his company announced it was converting from a nonprofit to a for-profit insurance company, HHS sent out a press release claiming that yet another insurer had, quote, collapsed. He doesn't want to get into a Washington spat.
I'd like to be purple politically.
But he's eager to describe technical fixes to the ACA he'd like to see. Changes to the risk adjustment program or special enrollment periods. Bottom line, he says, the Trump administration could patch up the Affordable Care Act, and if Congress wanted to get involved, they could make it work a lot better. But so far?
Honestly, I find all of Washington kind of confusing. I think that there's both productive and unproductive steps happening on a constant basis on, you know, all over on both sides of the aisle. It depends on what hour of the day, which if you step back, it's not a very good way to run in 1/6 of the U.S. economy.
Policelli takes comfort in a quote by Winston Churchill that says essentially, Americans will do the right thing in the end after they've tried everything else.
We've pretty much explored all the alternatives, and now it's time to fix things, get to work.
Allison Kojak, NPR News, Washington.
There's been wild weather in parts of the country. A team from the National Weather Service is headed to Maryland's eastern shore to determine whether a tornado touched down there early this morning. Homes and businesses were torn apart. Power was knocked out in the region. High winds closed the Chesapeake Bay Bridge down for more than an hour. State engineers say it was not damaged. And a wildfire in the Sierra Nevada foothills near Yosemite National Park is about 50% contained, but firefighters say they're bracing for the possibility of dry lightning strikes. The park, which is about 35 miles east of the fire, remains open, so hikers, pay attention. And now we all prepare to stand at attention for our look at national anthems. There's an ongoing debate in the Philippines about theirs, the Lupang Hinirang. A bill making its way through Congress in that country would require people to sing the anthem when it's played in public. Failing to sing it and sing it enthusiastically would be punishable with up to a year in prison and a fine, or up to $2,000. In India, the Supreme Court ruled a while back that movie theaters can be required to play the national anthem there before screenings and that people have to stand. A number of people have been arrested for not complying. And of course, here in the U.S., there's the controversy over Colin Kaepernick taking a knee during the anthem in protest over civil rights violations, probably why that football player is still a free agent. So national anthems matter. Alex Marshall is author of Republic or Death, Travels in Search of National Anthems. We spoke with him last year about his search and asked him how far he's gone.
Far too far, I think most people would say. I've traveled everywhere from Japan to Paraguay, South Africa to Kazakhstan. These songs are just so vital, which most people don't understand. They sum up our feelings about nationalism and our countries, but they can also stir passions, both positive and negative.
What do you make of the controversy in this country over athletes like Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the anthem, the football player kneeling rather than standing?
I'm actually really behind it because I think people should use these songs for what they believe in. And he's highlighted that it can be used to draw attention to issues. And if he believes in it that strongly, I think he should. You get examples of anthem protests all around the world, but you also get plenty of examples of people singing them proudly to make a point. I mean, if you look at the sort of Ukraine protests a few years ago, people gathered in Maidan Square in Kiev and sung their anthem, Ukraine's Not Dead Yet, on the hour, every hour, to almost to say, we are this country. That's why we want to take power. And so these songs can mean all sorts of different things to people. And I think it's important that we, you know, realize that and respect that use.
Well, and while he may want to take the knee to make his point, there are so many people who sing it out loudly in the U.S., and that affects other people. You met someone from another country who almost couldn't even speak about the line, the home of the brave and the land of the free, in our song, which some people take yes. for like, oh, my God, that's where they start yelling at sporting events. But it means something.
When I was traveling in America, I thought perhaps the most interesting encounter, one of the most interesting encounters I had was I just went to meet the composer of Nigeria's national anthem, who happens to be a professor at the University of Delaware. And I obviously asked him at one point, he turned out to be a naturalized American citizen. So I asked him, what does America's anthem mean to you? Expecting him to go, oh, it's nothing. You know, I wrote Nigeria's. I believe in Nigeria more than anything else. And he told me when he gets that line, he realized exactly what America had given to him. You know, it'd given him an opportunity which he couldn't have got at home. It's given him a life. It's given him a, you know, a family. And he said it might sound like the world's worst cliche. And in my opinion, it is the world's worst cliche. It's like an advertising slogan. But to him, it rung true. And when I heard that, it was actually a genuinely affecting moment.
Right. Well, and because it is the land of the free, you don't have to stand. And it's because you want to be the land of the free and not like Kazakhstan, for instance.
Yes. There are a few countries which are almost India's example, India's following, I suppose. One of them is Kazakhstan, where in 2012, an athlete was accidentally misplayed the fake Kazakh anthem from the film Borat. And they didn't seem to notice, which is slightly worrying, given all the lyrics are things like Kazakhstan has the best prostitutes in the region, except, of course, for Turkmenistan.
Well, I was referring to the fact that it's ruled by a strong man, a President Nursultan Nazarbayev,
who co-wrote it. And that's probably why when this incident happened, and when a subsequent one happened, when they played Living La Vida Loca, Ricky Martin's song, by accident, this law was immediately passed saying anyone who insults the anthem gets a year in prison.
And let's listen to a little of the Kazakhstan anthem, written again by the president of the country, who's, by the way, got statues of himself all over the country. Let's listen. Okay, Alex Marshall, we've set this up so that you could say how awful this is that he wrote this song.
I actually quite like
but,
it. That's
right.
The best thing. It's not bad. It does a trick. And the worst thing is I went to Kazakhstan expecting everyone to say, oh, dear God, this is awful. But even opponents of his regime, we would talk for, you know, hours about all the horrific things that have happened in the country. And I'd get to the song and they'd just go, do you know what? It's actually quite good. It's far better than the one we used to have.
By the way, do you know some of the lyrics?
There are things like the choruses, my country, as your flower I will be planted, as your song I will stream, my country, my native land, my Kazakhstan. He should have really put in a few references to himself in there, you get the feeling.
But to his credit, he didn't. Japan, a lot of tension around the national anthem there. Let's just listen to a little first. Now, Japan didn't change its national anthem after World War II. Germany and Italy did, to separate themselves from their part in the war. There was a lot of controversy. Some school teachers still refused to stand for it. But now, do we understand you can lose your job for not standing?
It depends where you are. But basically, teachers refused to stand for this for about, you know, literally been 70 years now. And in about the late 80s and the early 90s, politicians started to get fed up with this protest. And so they increasingly started passing laws saying, if you don't stand, you will be punished. And in the worst case, a woman, you know, she was fined a month's wage, then 3 months, then six. She was moved to school sort of 200 miles away from her home. So she was forced to commute for hours every day. And, you know, it seems bizarre because it is only a few people. And it's almost a complete suppression of freedom of speech and this desire that in Japan, everyone has to work for the group. And it says an awful lot about that country. And I feel very sorry for the few handouts who are just trying to make a moral stand.
Mm. Just before we let you go, Alex Marshall, I mean, there's so much power to a national anthem. I mean, I get tears. And yet you can also see how a national anthem, even though you might profoundly love your country, might represent a time in history as it does in Japan, or a lack of freedoms as it might to people in America who still don't feel they've achieved those freedoms. I mean, we can see how it's so much more important than we think it is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, that's what I think is the fascinating thing about these songs. When you dig under them, you suddenly reveal all these hidden meanings, these hidden histories. And that's why I think we should sort of look at them afresh and realize, almost take advantage of these sort of flashpoints to reassess them. And if we perhaps think about them more, we might decide if they are the right anthems for us. I mean, personally, my anthem, God Save the Queen, I think is an appalling song.
Not that you don't love the Queen.
I love the Queen. And I think, but it's, you know, it's musically and lyrically so drab. And it says nothing about, it's actually not really a national anthem. It doesn't say anything about the United Kingdom, Great Britain, England. It just says we have a Queen and we'd like her to rule for a long time. And in a way, it'd be nice if we had a song that actually talked about the country. I don't think we obviously couldn't steal Land of the Free and Home of the Brave for you. Maybe the Land of the, you know, slightly mediocre might work better for us. But it would be good to have something that talked about the people.
That's Alex Marshall, author of Republic or Death, Travels in Search of National Anthems. Alex, thank you.
Thanks very much.
I can see Brits across the country standing. Later today on All Things Considered, voting rights in a case from Texas where a 3-judge panel is expected to decide whether Texas violated Hispanics' voting rights when redistricting may have implications beyond the Lone Star State. That's later today. Right now, you're listening to Here and Now.
And here's some good news for once. Tuition increases are slowing at U.S. colleges after decades of hikes. The Wall Street Journal reports on new data from the Labor Department showing tuition at college and graduate school has come into line with overall inflation, rising just 1.9% in the year through June. So what's going on? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jamie.
And we should just lay out right at the top, it's not going up as fast, but it's still way more expensive to go to college than it was when you and I went to college. But what's going on here? What changed?
This is a huge change. For the last half century, you could have said the only certainties in life were death, taxes, and college tuition rising faster than inflation. Now that's back to just death and taxes. It's been a 400% growth in college prices over the last 3 decades. But today, as you mentioned, tuition inflation is now at its lowest rate on record. And so the trillion-dollar question is, why? And my short answer as the economic analyst here, I suppose, would be supply and demand. So with supply, we are running out of high school graduates. And I mean that literally. The number of teenagers has flatlined, and fewer people going to school means colleges are losing their ability to raise prices. They're losing the ability to dictate price. Number two is demand. The number of 2-year and 4-year colleges increased enormously in the last 30 years. But now the number of colleges is in decline. So you have flatlining high school graduates, fewer colleges, and as a result, it's not a good market for colleges to keep raising prices. And that is good news for teenagers and their families about to go to college today.
And are we talking, by the way, about all colleges and universities across the board or different kinds of them?
It's a great question. The answer is that these trends are most affecting for-profit schools. For-profit schools grew enormously in the first half of the 21st century, peaked in 2010, and now they are essentially collapsing, both in terms of the number of people going there. They tend to have older populations, the number of adults going there, and the amount of student debt that is now going to for-profit schools. Both of these are declining sharply, and this is good news. This reflects the fact that the government responded to the fact that a lot of these schools, maybe not all of them, but a lot of these for-profit schools were essentially debt mills. They were taking enormous amounts of student debt, taking adults who wouldn't necessarily finish their degrees and then were much more likely to default on their student debt. And so this is fantastic news that some of these schools are being regulated much more than they used to be by the government.
Now, you mentioned the trillion-dollar question, which is a reference to the $1 trillion of outstanding student debt. Is student debt declining as well as the college tuition costs are not going up as fast as they used to?
Right. The picture here is mixed. Student debt is still rising, but it's rising more slowly than any time in the last 20 years. So there's a little bit of good news, bad news there. And again, if you're asking, you know, why is the growth of student debt slowing down? Well, it's the same reasons. You have fewer people who are a part of the 17, 18-year-old cohort who are going to college. You have more public awareness about the dangers of taking on too much student debt. You have public pressure on some of these universities to give especially middle class and lower income people more generous student aid packages or give them, you know, better discounts on college. And so you put this all together and you have an improving picture in the growth of student debt, but you still have, I think, about $1.4 trillion of student debt in this country. That's quite a lot.
How are schools trying to make more money if they're not able to raise prices as much as they used to?
Right, exactly. If the average American is paying less to go to college, then how are these colleges making money? And the answer is they're allowing much more, they're accepting way more international students who are more likely to pay full freight. And so, you know, these colleges are, you know, not officially businesses, but essentially businesses. And they are trying to make as much money per consumer, per student as possible. And often that means for a public school taking in more out-of-state students or for any school taking in more international students, maximizing the number of students you can take who are willing to pay, or more likely their families willing to pay, full freight.
Derek, is anyone at this point, because we heard a lot of this in the campaign in 2016, is anyone talking about solutions to this problem and specifically to the student debt crisis?
Yeah, there have been politicians talking about solutions. I'm mostly familiar with Barack Obama's plan to his pay-as-you-earn plan, which essentially limits the amount of student debt per month that graduates have to pay. That has been relatively successful for those students who or graduates who know about it. Then, of course, you have Bernie Sanders' plan to make college public college free for an enormous number of students. That certainly would help the student debt picture. And even more recently, I think you have more people talking about, okay, can we make student debt dischargeable in bankruptcy? Are there other things that we can do? It's a complex issue, and there are ways you can come at it either, you know, from the private sector side in terms of bankruptcy regulation or from the public sector side in terms of making college free.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.